Welcome to the Decoding Culture Podcast. The podcast focuses on the importance that culture plays in all areas of business and society, from how it shapes organizations, work, and leadership, to how it influences consumer experience, innovation, design, and larger societal trends. My name is John Curran, and I'm your host. I'm a business anthropologist, executive coach, and CEO of JC & Associates, which is a consultancy that helps businesses develop better working cultures and relationships with their consumers. Now, you might have noticed in some of my previous podcast episodes, I've interviewed academics from business schools. The reason for this is that I'm interested in how some of these academic institutions, and especially business schools, use anthropological theory as a means of developing business models. I think this is a really exciting space, how business and anthropology are coming together. Now, in part two of my conversation with Professor Jennifer Howard-Grenfell, who is the Diageo Professor of Organization Studies at Cambridge Judge Business School, Cambridge University, we develop further the concept of organizational culture. We discuss Professor Howard-Grenfell's use of the anthropological theory called liminality as a process for cultural change in organizations. We also discuss the future of work and the office and remote working and what this might all look like post-pandemic. Now, since the Decoding Culture podcast has a new home, you will need to subscribe to the new feed. I also want to tell you about an exciting new training course I've developed that focuses on organizational culture and the client-agency relationship. I'm running this in partnership with Epic, and more details can be found in the show notes. I hope you enjoy episode two. What I'd really like to do now is go on to another paper of yours. Liminality is a culture process to cultural change, or as a process to cultural change. When I saw this, I was delighted because liminality is such a, well, number one, it's such a beautiful creative theory, but secondly, it's at the heart of anthropology and it was born out of anthropology. So seeing this being used within a business school setting is fantastic, and it's probably worth me referencing that I also interviewed Dr. Letitia Mamoon at CAS Business School, who's looking at liminality in relation to consumers. So it's great to see that opening up. But I'd like to kind of start with, you know, how would you define liminality and why is it important when understanding organizational culture?
Mm-hmm. So we, and it's interesting because it was actually through my colleague, Karen Golden-Biddle, who I was working with on this paper, that we sort of brought in this notion of liminality, drawing largely from Turner's work. And, you know, so obviously the symbolic is very important in sort of a liminal phase or liminal experience. And we found that this notion of, you know, liminal experiences put as he says, betwixt and between. So it's both referencing what is normal and familiar, yet not fully embedded within those structures and norms and symbols of the normal and the familiar. Right, so it's both familiar and unfamiliar at the same time, and of course the idea of the sort of, you know, the ritual and the threshold through which one moves is less salient, and in fact that's not how we use the notion of liminality. We use it in its more, in the sense that he refers to much more in sort of modern life liminality, which is this ability to hold both the familiar and the unfamiliar. And importantly, I think some people who've cited this work sort of talk about a liminal space, and for us there's nothing physical about, you know, a liminal space. You don't craft, you know, you don't go into a meeting room and put a whole bunch of big post-it notes on the wall and declare that that is a liminal space. Yeah. Actually, for us, it is a liminal experience. It's the ability for certain people and organizations to bring forward this experience for others and themselves of being both referencing what our normal culture is, the familiar, yet introducing some unfamiliar elements. And importantly for us, it's not just doing that for the sake of doing it. It's so that you can introduce a change. Again, as I was talking about earlier, using those opportunities to bring into a culture a new concern or new issue or new direction, I suppose, that hasn't been represented there before, but yet can be connected to the familiar and therefore worked upon.
You use the term, I think you we're bracketing kind of everyday behavior in an organization. We're bracketing from, but still connected to everyday actions. So this is this. Are there some kind of examples, some kind of tangible example there of what would a bracketing or mm-hmm. that process of bracketing look like?
Yeah. So, you know, it's the setting apart. And it's the moving out of what might be the just the familiar normal way of doing, you know, I guess in this work environment, Zoom meetings all day, and having that sort of offsite or strategy day or what have you. Those are familiar for people who are making change interventions in organizations. So those are sort of bracketed apart from, you know, we're stepping outside the normal flow of activity to, and again, a Turner terminology, think about how we think, right? Okay. And so it's presented as an opportunity for reflection. It also, in the study, we found people not just created these opportunities, but they also thought about role relationships within them. So we were just talking recently about we would expect subcultures, we also expect power, you know, hierarchies and all sorts of ways in which people relate in sort of normal organizational life. And the people who compose these liminal experiences thought very hard about how do we break down or even sometimes reverse or inverse those role expectations? How do we give people an opportunity to do something differently? And importantly, it wasn't just think about how you think, it's also play, experience, emote. And so for us, that was the power of thinking about these experiences as liminal, which is they were set apart from the everyday, not just structurally and in terms of we're turning off our phones now, but we are going to play. So we talk, one of the people that we looked at in this study would, you know, he said they were going to go salmon fishing, but this was in Wales and the weather was too foul for salmon fishing. So they didn't fish. They just sat by the river and, you know, drank and mused. And so the bracketing need not look at all typical, but it is an intentional opportunity to create a different way of relating both to each other and to the norms in the organization.
That's interesting. So I'm going to just play with that or kind of probe a little bit, because one way that I could say visualize that is that if we're having workshops or meetings, that the workshop has a functional process to it, that there's an outcome that's needed, there's a reason why you're having it, but that can have liminal elements to it. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Because I guess one thing we could look at, say, trends or design thinking or sprints, scrums, agile, mm-hmm. all these terminologies, but they're incorporated very much as part of a culture of an organization, especially within tech. Right. And so does it become normal or is it actually liminal? That's, I guess...
Yeah. So one person's liminal might be another person's normal. And I think that's what's important. You know, the individuals that we studied in these organizations, what I found so fascinating about them, in fact, to a person, the reason we wrote this paper was this deep sense of puzzlement. And in fact, it was the man who organized the salmon fishing. And I had interviewed him for a completely different project. And I walked away thinking, why does his company employ this man? You know, not in a negative way. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy, incredibly broad thinker. We were talking to him about sustainability, and this was more than a decade ago, he was so far ahead of anyone I'd spoken to on the issue of sustainability, not just environmental, but social, that it kind of blew my mind. And he was working for an alcoholic drinks manufacturer that has since been acquired by much, much larger groups. And I thought, I don't get it. I just don't get it. You know, he's so different. Yet he had been very successful in introducing new ways of thinking and doing things in that organization. And the other individuals that show up in the paper, similarly, you sort of looked at them and you thought, that's so interesting. And now when we probed a little more, it wasn't that they'd been hired at the Maverick or to, you know, inculcate these new ways of doing liminality and create design thinking or whatever equivalents as the new normal. Far from it. This guy had started in the IT department some decades earlier. You know, the woman that I studied at the apparel company, she'd been in marketing for years. So they had been with these organizations for a long period of time doing something that actually had nothing to do with the change that they were now trying to create. And I think that is what made them so skillful at being able to create these experiences, because they absolutely knew what that culture was about. They knew how people did things. You know, they knew how the equivalent of Bob on that factory floor, brewing beer or cider or whatever it was, thought and worked, and what was expected, you know, of Bob's world. And that's what made them able to sort of infuse these opportunities. So they were not oriented to, we must create new processes in the organization. They were oriented to, we must create new ways of thinking about certain issues such that our organization can act on them. And they were very creative. So one liminal experience need not look like another, but they generally involved these elements. They were bracketed away from the everyday. They introduced a challenge in terms of sort of new ways of thinking. They eased some of the rules and structures, so they enabled people to be immersed in this, because of course there's some discomfort with it. So there was often a bit more of a playful element or that kind of thing to it. Role reversals, as I mentioned.
Right. Okay. I think that it kind of brings in, because you've really focused there on individuals and the role of the individual, knowing their organization, knowing their organizational culture. And one thing that you also write about is that you describe a process whereby people and teams learn new additional cultural resources that become part of an existing cultural repertoire. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's fascinating. Instead of it saying new cultural resources or new resources as a means of defining a new cultural repertoire, it becomes part of.
Yeah.
Is that, can you kind of elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah. So the idea being that, again, we take some cultural practice, some cultural tool from our toolkit, some habit or skill that we know we are very good at, that people are very good at, that people are very comfortable with. But we slowly, over time, through not just one, but many liminal experiences, and then through the other processes that we unpack in the paper, of sort of, you know, bringing these back into the everyday and enabling other people to see how they work. So let's go to the apparel company, where what they did was they created a number of opportunities for people to challenge themselves and to think about how they think and to learn about sustainability. And this was the early days of this. So the notion of peak oil seemed very strategic, mm-hmm. but they were using it essentially as they said, as a sort of a Trojan horse to get people to think about these issues. They had the kind of opportunity where you do a waste audit and you dump all of the waste from the cafeteria out on the floor and people can see, you know, just how badly the recyclables have been separated, for example. And so these sort of visual demonstrations and opportunities, and sometimes they went too far. They said to us, you know, occasionally the antibodies came out because we were seen as these tree huggers. But what they did over time was they seeded these ideas, but they also set people discrete tasks. So people who were interested in being involved in these would go back into their own parts of the business and say, now you're going to do something innovative around the issue of sustainability. You're going to try it out, right, in your role as a product designer or in your role as a marketer. And so they set people tasks with defined start and end dates, with deliverables that they could help define themselves. They gave them resources to do it, and they set them off to do it and see what they would do. Over the years, what happens is some of these things come to fruition, and they become symbolically very important to others in the organization. Mm-hmm. The first shoe that is designed with a very, very high level of attention to not using toxic chemicals in the manufacture, which has both environmental benefits and also health and safety benefits for the people who are doing the assembly, if you're using fewer glues and adhesives and that kind of thing. All sorts of other metrics that they had developed internally, they were able to realize in an actual product. And so showing to other employees that actually we can do the things that we do, which is cutting edge design, which is innovating around athletic performance, frankly, and we can do it in a way that incorporates these principles of sustainability. So actually realizing some of the things that come out of these early liminal experiences, not just allowing it being betwixt and between, and then now everyone goes back to their normal work, but actually realizing some of those and demonstrating. So that's what we mean by bringing in this idea. And in fact, the CEO of that company is on record of saying that actually sustainability is now central to how they do an innovation. And that to me is this sort of notion of resourcing this cultural proclivity to be innovative and attaching to it a new meaning. Innovation is what we do, but now innovation also means thinking about sustainability. It doesn't mean we have a whole new aspect of our culture, which is about sustainability. Mm-hmm. It means that's the way that we're doing this thing. That's or that's an orientation to which this thing that we've done all along is now now moving.
This, I mean, you've touched on some of this, my next kind of question, but one thing I was really taken and interested about in the paper was this idea of driving change without a jolt or a trigger. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you use the term crafting liminality for cultural change. Now, one of the things is that, you know, change either has conflict within it, needs conflict. We could talk about that in a bit, but this idea of the not needing necessarily a jolt or a trigger to push change, that's something I'd really like to hear a little bit more about. And maybe it dovetails in with the paper as well, because what you also do deliver is a kind of a model of three central processes of using liminality as a means of getting change. I'm just wondering if you could kind of talk through that a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, this was a big thing that we considered, and this is in part where the title comes from, a cultural process for cultural change, because when we read most of the things about how do you create cultural change in an organization, it is about a jolt that either comes externally, there's a distinct need for it, or we've just merged with another organization, and so we need to actually have a strong look at what the culture is and try to align it, for example, or it comes about you know, the sort of the mechanism through which it comes about are very much structural, or exercised through power relations. So this sort of top down and, you know, and now HR is going to define for us a whole suite of aspirational culture, and we're going to then associate it with a whole lot of behaviors, and then we're going to drive it on through. So the mechanism of bringing about cultural change, curiously enough, is almost always about, you know, structural approaches or process approaches. So that was a bit of a puzzle for us, was again coming out of these individuals that we had seen at work. And they had been doing this for a period of years, if not decades. So I would be remiss to say that you can do it without a jolt and immediately. Yeah. Far from it, actually. But you can do it intentionally and without a jolt, in the sense that it is your intention to move the culture towards acting on a certain type of issue, and that you are aware of which aspects of that cultural toolkit might be most amenable to be attached to, or as we say in the paper, sort of resourced towards that issue. And in the sort of three practices we lay out, we do first, you know, what we talked about as bracketing early on, this notion of resourcing the everyday as liminal. So we're very much driven by work by Martha Feldman, primarily, who talks about, you know, resources aren't things that just exist sitting around waiting for us to pick them up and take them. People bring things into being, right? People bring into being the capacity for other things to happen. So creating these experiences as a opportunity for others to come and be engaged in a different way, as an opportunity to resource everyday experiences as something that could be liminal, which isn't transformative, but it's eye-opening, right? So that's the first stage. The next stage is actually within those spaces, mixing and matching. So if it's betwixt and between, you don't just relax the familiar, you bring in the unfamiliar. So expose people to gurus, ideas, ways of doing things that they haven't experienced before, yet doing it in a way that is safe, that is somehow connected to also the cultural norms that people know. And then the final part is having sort of juxtaposed these existing and new, these familiar and unfamiliar, how do we actually take that back into the organization and back into the everyday? And that relates to sort of what I was just talking about with, you know, actually materializing some of the outputs and letting the rest of the organization see it, and doing it in the same way, using the same, you know, for example, again, to the apparel company, when they wanted to share the outputs of what had happened, they used the same, you know, really slick production of video and other material that everyone else in the organization used to show that they were connecting with their way of doing things. It's not just this sort of, you know, hippie faction out there doing something differently. It gets reintegrated. And that's probably the most crucial thing of reintegrating and pulling others along who might not have actually been part of these betwixt and between experiences, but that can now start to see the connections.
You've just kind of, you've described, and for the listeners who don't know, but a lot of the liminality theory came also from Van Gennep and the initiation ritual, right? Yeah, and if you imagine a girl or a boy transforming into a female or a male, the tradition was, or you know, that you have some form of liminal ritual that can be long term or could be short, but you there's a conclusion, isn't there? You're coming back, and you transform from a child to an adult.
Yeah.
And that comes with other values and other responsibilities. So this last bit, which you mentioned then about changing the seeds or making them into actions, you're right. You mentioned how important that is, but it is, it's critical, isn't it? Otherwise it just dies down and we've had a great workshop and we high five.
Right.
But then we go back to our desks, think about our KPIs, et cetera. And it feels like to make it work, accountability, leadership, that whole restructuring of what a KPI is, for example, needs to be rethought to allow and accommodate this new liminal process.
I think you know, I absolutely appreciate you raising that, because I think this is one of the biggest issues, is even though we talk about this as a cultural process, so it's a symbolic process, it's a process in which meaning is brought forward, it's a process in which we think about how we think, it's a process in which we recompose and recombine the symbols and meanings that are important to us as a group, but all of that can go out the window if we just get back to the office the next day and are into the same mode. So the structural and process aspects that underpin culture absolutely have to not only be there, but my colleague Herminia Ibarra at the London Business School has a lovely article in the MIT Sloan Management Review that talks about how very important it is for leaders to get rid of the rituals and symbolic aspects that are actually undercutting the change that they're trying to make culturally, because we find organizations who are, you know, well-meaningly doing all sorts of important things to push through or to, you know, to forge along a new path, but inadvertently or not, there are some things that are really visible, tangible, you know, tangibly communicating a way of doing things that we're no longer trying to do. So I think in another paper that I've written on this, you know, in this paper, we argue strongly, you don't need to unlearn to learn more about culture and to resource it differently, to use it differently, as I've been talking about. But in another paper, I actually am working with other colleagues where we see an organization that, you know, again, using this sort of repertoire perspective, you need to suppress certain elements. You might not be able to completely rid the organization of them, but you absolutely need to amplify certain elements and suppress others in order to create a desired change.
The last thing I want to really touch on in the paper about liminality is something that you describe so clearly and kind of ethnographically as well. But it was really promoting this idea of the importance of the insider. And you've mentioned this as well with the people who were there for a long time in an organization who could really read the culture, see where the kind of the tension points are. Does that make the kind of outsider slash me as a consultant less influential? I mean, you know, I really like this idea of the insider. I guess there's always been that thing of the outsider consultant in inside consultancy and how that works. But maybe just talk through a little bit about why the insider is seen as important.
Sure. I mean, I think I covered that, in just these individuals. It was so fascinating to us that they just deeply knew their organizations, and they had this ability to read the organization and be very smart about which aspects, you know, they were amplifying, which aspects they were connecting their new concerns to. So that is the value of being an insider, but I would say they were essentially outsider insiders. I think they may well actually have seen themselves that way. And I'm sure you've come across this too, which is people who are close observers of their culture. Maureen Scully and Deborah Meyerson have written ages ago about the notion of tempered radicals, and tempered radicalism, which is people who are within the organization, they are committed to the organization, but they also are in some ways not against the organization, but really desiring that the organization was more reflective of a certain set of commitments or, dare I say, values. And they talk about the importance of tempered radicals being able to rock the boat without falling out. So to have credibility in an organization, to be allowed to be outside, coming back to this guy that we call William in the paper, you know, and I just, my incredible puzzle, which was nothing to do with why we were interviewing him in the first place, but my incredible puzzle was, I am so fascinated that your organization keeps you here because you were pushing them so hard. So to come back to the role for people like you, no, absolutely. I think you can be the people who are bringing in and provoking this opportunity to expose to the unfamiliar, because if you know, you need people to know the familiar to even open that up, but you also need people who are and who embody and who can provoke the unfamiliar, who can bring in these additional sort of ways of thinking about things, or cultural resources, and connect those. So I think the insiders we have highlighted in this paper may be, they are absolutely insiders, but they may be less inside than others. And B, they always worked in close consultation with others outside who could help with this recomposition, and bringing forth the unfamiliar and thinking very carefully about how to do that. So I think there's a role for you still, John.
Thank you. the final part, I think our listeners and probably ourselves as well would be rather surprised and confused if we weren't going to be talking about organizational culture, and business and work, where we are now, kind of this idea of living within this complete abstract, I don't call it dystopian, but abstract pandemic lockdown. And, you know, I'm sure we could do I have almost a kind of online ethnographic study and observation of LinkedIn, and it's everyone scrabbling for space to be able to say, what is the future of work, flexible work, this type of work, Zoom was it, now we're tired of Zoom, now our well-being in Zoom, you know, there's so many different narratives being thrown around. So we're kind of thinking about speculating the future of post-pandemic, you know. I'm kind of thinking about the kind of broad question is, what do you think this future will look like for business and organizational culture? I'm kind of throwing it out. I don't really think there's much to kind of tie it onto.
You're absolutely right. We would be remiss not to talk about it. And in fact, I've been thinking a lot about it. I'm not sure I have the definitive answer. I'm not sure any of us do. I think when you say, what does the future of business looks like, it absolutely depends on the business. You know, if you want to talk about an airline versus, you know, a bank with offices in central London versus an online delivery grocery. But I think if we look at sort of office-based, you know, what we might call knowledge work, where the issue of organizational culture is often extremely salient, and I think many of our assumptions about sort of how cultures work are founded in those environments, you know, absolutely a lot has changed. In fact, I have a piece that will come out as we're recording in the last week of June. It will come out this week in the MIT Sloan Management Review on that very question of what do you... you know, how does one support a culture? How does one maintain an organizational culture when everyone, at least now, is working remotely in these kind of office environment settings? And there's so much that we could talk about, and we've already been talking for a long time. But, you know, there are many benefits. I think people are able to slow down a little bit in some cases. In other cases, they are actually just scrambling. But I think ultimately we have lost something, and we will continue to lose much more if people are not physically co-present in the way that they are used to. So I cite in this article IBM, which was one of the sort of forerunners in you know, telecommuting. 40% of its workforce was working remotely in 2009. In 2017, they made headlines when they had thousands of those employees come back to the office because, okay, A, employees weren't particularly happy necessarily being remote, or at least not all of them were. They weren't necessarily, you know, there's evidence out there that people don't get promoted as rapidly as their peers who are face to face. Certainly in terms of creativity, problem solving, all of the things that we associate with, you know, having sort of a team engagement. I mean, we've just been talking about liminality. It would be hard to do that over Zoom, right? These kind of experiences where people are really pushed to some degree, a little bit outside their comfort zone. And so I think there is no substitute for physically being present. So much of what we do as humans and how we interact is embodied. Right. It's not just my gesture. You know, I see you nodding and I'm waving my arms wildly here, but you know, that's all fine and good that we can see that over Zoom. But other aspects of who we are and how we communicate relationally are hugely embodied. And it's, you know, it's to do with our ability to monitor almost the emotional and relational tone as well. So it's not just how am I gesturing, but what do I know about that person and what have I known about that person and how is that different today than it might have been on other days? Building trust. I think about socialization and recruitment. If you were new to an organization right now, how on earth would you figure it out? You know, literally, how on earth would you know what's expected of you and how are you to act? Now, I say that with a little bit of sort of, you know, maybe it's just reflecting my age, because I do see, you know, the younger generation, people who are in their undergraduate and graduate years at university right now, doing incredible things. And, you know, for them, actually being able to coordinate and meet online and you know, do things, it's just how they do things. So maybe it's not so bad if we're not physically co-present, but I do think that that will have a huge impact on culture. And in this article, I talk about, you know, the things that need to happen, which are getting back to this point about the role for leadership, just literally articulating it. When you see it happen, when you see your culture in action, remind people that that is what it is and that is your culture and that it has value, because we can't just go on autopilot with these things. You know, otherwise we get a really messy toolkit. You know, thinking about what are the ways in which actually this lack of co-presence has brought about new ways of working and accommodating that actually might enrich our cultural toolkit. How might we have actually figured out ways that Zoom actually makes us better at doing something?
Sure.
That my experience in another kind of environment online is starting to infuse my work environment online. And also, you know, I think this is a really good time, you know, kind of that. People sometimes get confused about, well, what is my culture versus what is my identity as an organization? My culture is how I do things. My identity is who I think I am. But they're obviously enmeshed with each other. This comes back to the sort of role of the founding, the founders and founding ideas of how we work together. And so reminding people of who we were and who we still are and why that matters is actually one way of articulating, you know, what this organization is about and how it can, despite having a different set of realities in terms of face-to-face versus online or operating versus not operating or, you know, operating in a way that's completely bizarre to people, being able to actually point back to those moments in history that illustrate who we are and what we've done to in the past, I think are going to be important for organizations.
Yeah, I think that you've touched on it. It's almost like you've kind of defined we're actually going to be entering into more liminality on a wider scale, not for kind of intentional culture change, but there are so many different narratives going on at the moment, from everything from office design and how do we work, sort of physical body and safety, right? But then we know that the physical body and embodiment is also political, social, and cultural as well, which is also coming into play. And where does that sit? So, you know, I've been very interested in this idea. Well, if the physical space has to be safe, who makes that safe space? It's architects and also cleaners and domestics who are, you know, so there's a whole morality and ethics. There's things like we've seen Black Lives Matter about what's the actual, is there a chance then for change there?
Right.
It's going to be very interesting to see how almost these culture clashes are going to work through. But I'm totally in agreement about the embodiment and the need for the physical body and what that means
to
have other people. We know that from sociology, Irvin Goffman, about knowing who I am through who they are. And that's how we work. And even the commute, which is seen as this dreadful thing, has a lot of cultural value.
I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, stepping back a bit to sort of thinking about what is culture, not just organizational culture, you know, so the kind of close-in question is, how will organizations cope when people aren't at the office, you know, and sort of the proverbial water cooler isn't there, right, for people to gather around and have the informal interaction around. I think the bigger question that you raise is really important and interesting, which is this is a liminal phase, I suppose, or it's just a profoundly disturbing phase where we have been forced to be in the unfamiliar in a way that is prolonged and in a way that we have so limited control over. And there are so many layers. So way back when I was a PhD student, I used Mary Douglas's work a lot and, you know, and related the sort of the ideas about how do we parse as cultures, you know, within versus without, the safe and the dangerous. And those, as you know, are political, they're societal, but you can see even now in this country, we are dancing around whether we're 2 meters or 1 meter apart.
Yeah.
This is a hugely consequential meter. And that is not just, you know, that is defined for us on the basis of a whole lot of considerations by a certain set of people who will then impose upon us what is safe. Right.
Yeah.
And the fact that we as individuals, I think, are so many of us are struggling with, well, what do we do next according to these new rules of what is safe and how do we trust and normalize what is safe? And it is actually, as Anne Swidler talks about, unsettled periods of being ripe with opportunity for culture. And I think they're scary, you know, and this actually helps me think about organizational culture change too, right? Which is fundamentally scary because culture is what gives us the ability to trust in others around us, to, you know, to sort of make sense of our worlds, to sort of cognitively and you know, embodiedly simplify things. And now we are in this moment of transformation. We don't know quite when it will end. We don't know how it will end. And certain people have more power to redraw these lines. But there's no particular reason, you know, at least there wasn't until recently, to think so, you know, to think that certain of these distinctions were so important. So we're not actually culturally capable of you know, this notion of social distancing is not part of our cultural capacity.
No.
It has been forced upon us, but then what that means and how we negotiate that, I think it's with us for years.
Yeah.
And I think it's with, you know, if you look across the age groups and the demographics and, you know, not just work, but all settings. There'll be a lot of interesting anthropological and sociological work to come.
I think this is demanding this conversation that within maybe in 6 months or something, we need to revisit and have another podcast actually about just what we're sensing at the moment, because I think it's something that also people, I think, need to be able to listen to and make sense for themselves as well. Because on the one hand, it feels like we're all in it together. And on the other hand, it feels very kind of isolated and individual. We're going to wrap up. I'm going to ask you the final question, which I ask all my guests. So I'm going to hand over the anthropologist's notebook for you to take away for a study. And you can study any organization or industry for a year. But what I want to know is which organization or industry and why?
I chose an industry. And I chose the fossil fuel industry. And I will need more than a year. Okay. But a year would get me started. You know, the reason is because I think that the issues that are playing out, especially in the large companies in that industry, but all of the other parts of the value chain, are so fundamental in terms of never before have we seen an industry in which they know exactly what is going to happen about 3 decades from now or about a generation from now, but they have to figure out how to basically wind down. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we've ever seen an industry put itself out of business, not with that kind of lead time, not without a massive sort of technological disruptive shock. And I think actually true change is going to take a generation, so that's the good news. The bad news is they need to be investing today or de-investing or, you know, changing how they think about production, because you don't just, you know, in that industry, you don't turn assets on and off overnight.
Yeah.
And, you know, meantime, you have some of the leading companies coming out and saying that they're thinking very, very seriously about climate change and, of course, their role in it, which essentially means that they're fundamentally rethinking. You know, even some of these companies I've heard saying, you know, we're in the business of extracting hydrocarbons and we need to figure out how to take the H apart from the Cs, you know, the hydrogen apart from the carbon, because it's the carbon that we don't want. But hydrogen, you know, it's fantastic alternative fuel, potentially. They have massive engineering capacity and capability and the ways that they think about the future, the ways that they think about risk, the ways that they think about long-term development, the way they finance things, has been so oriented to this single type of product. How do you actually, you know, A, continue to supply that product? Because last I checked, every single one of us on the planet are relying on it to some degree, and B, wind yourself down out of that, and ideally C, reorient towards some fundamentally different capability. So given the sort of interest in sustainability that I have, I think that's fascinating. Given the interest in culture that I have, I think it goes again to some of these core questions about, you know, what is it that we do? What, you know, what is safe? What is unsafe? What is appropriate? What is inappropriate? What is the state of knowledge? What is this, you know, how do we view time? I mean, there's fundamentally sort of core cultural questions that are challenging, I think, if people in that industry are thinking carefully about the issues. And I think it would be fascinating to see what's going on there.
Great. Well, listen, Jen, thank you so much for being on Decoding Culture. I know that the listeners are going to really find this appreciated. And let's do touch base in 6 months. I'd love to kind of reset and see where we are again from a cultural point of view.
Fantastic. John, it's been really excellent talking to you. I've really enjoyed it fully. And I would look forward to an opportunity in 6 months to see how we're doing on this question of culture and the current pandemic and what it's changed. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Decoding Culture podcast. I hope some of the points that Jen and I discussed have helped you understand why it is really important to dive into understanding what organizational culture is and how it can be used for change. Now, since recording this episode, Jen has published a very important article for the MIT Sloan Management Review called How to Sustain Your Organizational Culture When Everyone is Remote. So I'll put that link into the show notes. Please do subscribe to the new feed or on iTunes, and please also give it a rating on iTunes. To keep up to date with interesting trends on culture, business, and anthropology, then sign up to my Decoding Culture newsletter. The link, along with the link to my training course, is also in the show notes.